All right, everyone, welcome to another deep dive. And today we're going to be looking at a situation that I think is going to hit close to home for a lot of us. It's what happens when you're a guest in someone's house and something terrible happens, like their family member attacks you. Can your friend actually be held responsible for that?
Oh, yeah, that's a really good question. And it's one that the courts have grappled with for a long time. And there's this really interesting case in Illinois, Barmore v. Elmore, that really gets to the heart of this issue.
So Barmore v. Elmore. Okay, let's break this down. So in this case, we've got Leon Barmore. He's visiting the Elmore family. And the reason for the visit is to discuss some Masonic Lodge business. Seems pretty harmless, right?
Yeah, it does seem pretty harmless. Just a, you know, a friendly visit to talk about some organizational stuff. But here's where things take a dark turn. While Barmore is at the house, the Elmore's son, Thomas Jr., attacks him with a knife.
Oh, wow. Hold on. So just out of the blue, this guy gets attacked. That's terrifying. I mean, just imagine you're sitting there talking about, you know, whatever Masonic lodges talk about, and suddenly you're in a life or death situation.
Right. It's a total nightmare scenario. And it raises so many questions about responsibility and liability. I mean, who could have seen this coming? And could it have been prevented?
Okay, so let's back up for a second. You mentioned that Barmore was there to discuss Masonic Lodge business. So he wasn't just like a random friend dropping by for coffee. Does that matter legally?
It absolutely does, because even though he was there for a meeting, it was for an organization, and that makes him what the law calls a licensee, essentially a social guest.
Wait, so even though he had a specific purpose for being there, he's still considered a social guest. Why does that distinction matter?
It matters because it affects the level of duty that the homeowner owes to the person on their property. An invitee, someone who's there to benefit the homeowner directly, like, say, a plumber coming to fix a leaky faucet, they're owed a higher duty of care.
So if I'm hiring someone to do work in my house, I need to be extra careful. But if I invite friends over, I have less legal responsibility for their safety.
In a way, yes. But it's not that you can totally disregard the safety of your guests. The legal standard for proving negligence is just higher. The law recognizes that, you know, homeowners can't be expected to foresee every possible danger, especially when it comes to actions of other adults.
Okay, but in this case, the son had a history of emotional problems, didn't he? And even some past violence. Shouldn't that change things?
It definitely does, and that's where this concept of foreseeability comes in. The court had to figure out if, knowing their son's history, the Elmores should have reasonably anticipated this attack.
So what do they actually know about their son's past? And how long ago were these previous incidents?
Well, here's the thing. Thomas Jr. did have a history of emotional disorders. And yes, there were some violent incidents in his past. But these were almost a decade before the attack on Barmore.
A decade. Wow. So in the years leading up to this, he had been seemingly doing okay.
Right? He had been receiving treatment, held down a job, lived independently. He had only recently moved back in with his parents after losing his job.
Okay, so this wasn't a case of the parents harboring some, you know, obviously dangerous person. Their son was seemingly on a good path, and then this horrible thing happens.
It's a really tough situation, and it puts the court in a tricky position because on the one hand, you have this tragic event, and on the other hand, you have parents who, it seems like, were trying to support their son. So the question becomes, was this attack truly foreseeable given everything the Elmores knew at the time?
And what did the court ultimately decide? Did they say that the parents should have known better?
Well, the court took a very close look at all the evidence, and they basically said, nope, there's no way the Elmores could have reasonably predicted this. Remember, 10 years of stability, no recent warning signs, nothing to suggest the son was an imminent threat.
Imminent threat. So it sounds like that's a key factor here. But I'm still wondering, even if it was 10 years ago, wouldn't a reasonable person be at least a little cautious knowing about someone's violent past?
That's a good point. And you're right, there's definitely a gray area here. I mean, humanly speaking, we might say, well, they should have been more careful. But the law has to operate within a framework of fairness and practicality. If we start holding people liable for every bad thing that could happen, just because they had some inkling of a possibility, it would make social interactions incredibly difficult.
So it's like a balancing act. We need to find a way to protect people without making everyone live in fear of being sued for something they couldn't have possibly foreseen.
Exactly. And the court in Barmore really emphasized that their decision was based on the very specific facts of this case. Had there been even one recent incident, even something minor, it's likely they would have ruled differently.
One recent incident. Okay, so it seems like that's a major factor in determining foreseeability. But what exactly qualifies as a recent incident? And how do courts draw the line between what's foreseeable and what's not?
Those are great questions. And to really understand how this all works, it helps to look at some other cases where courts have wrestled with similar issues. So in our next segment, we're going to dive into some contrasting cases that'll really shed light on the complexities of foreseeability and the factors that courts consider when deciding whether a homeowner has breached their duty of care.
Okay, so we're back, and I'm ready to hear about these other cases, you know, to see how they compare to Barmore. But first, before we move on, I'm kind of curious, what was Barmore's legal strategy in all this? I mean, how do you even argue that the Elmores were negligent when it seems like their son acted independently?
Well, Barmore's lawyers actually focused on two main points. First, they argued that the Elmores failed to warn Barmore about their son's potential for violence.
So even if the court said the attack wasn't foreseeable, are they saying the parents still had a duty to warn, even if they thought the son was doing better?
Yeah, essentially. It goes back to that idea that homeowners have a duty to warn guests about hidden dangers, even if those dangers come in human form.
Right.
It's like saying, look, you don't have to lock your son in the basement, but maybe you shouldn't leave him unsupervised with a bunch of guests.
Hmm. Interesting. So what was their second argument?
Their second argument was that the Elmores failed to take any steps to actually protect Barmore from their son.
I'm not sure I follow that one. I mean, how do you prove that someone should have prevented something that hadn't happened yet? It's not like a thought crime, isn't it?
It is a tough argument to make, and that's why foreseeability is so important in these cases. If, let's say, the son had been making threats or acting strangely in the days or weeks before Barmore's visit, then the argument for a duty to protect would have been a lot stronger.
So it's not enough to just know about someone's past. There has to be some kind of recent evidence that they might cause trouble now.
Exactly. Think of it like this. The law doesn't expect homeowners to be mind readers, but it does expect them to be reasonable and to act on the information they have. So if there are red flags, well, they need to pay attention to those red flags.
Okay, so back to the Barmore case. We know the court ruled in favor of the Elmores, but how did they justify that decision given the son's history?
They looked at all the evidence, really scrutinized it, and in the end they said there's just no way the Elmores could have predicted this attack. Remember, we're talking about a decade of stability. No recent warning signs, nothing to suggest that the son was a threat at that time.
Yeah, imminent threat, we keep coming back to that phrase. But honestly, it still feels kind of iffy. Like, even if it was 10 years ago, wouldn't a reasonable person be at least a little worried knowing about someone's violent past?
You're hitting on something really important here, and it's where things get kind of philosophical because, yeah, humanly speaking, we might say, well, they should have been more careful. But the law has to be practical. It has to be fair. If we started holding people liable for everything bad that could happen, just because they had some small suspicion, it would be impossible to live a normal life.
Right. We can't expect people to be constantly on edge, worrying about every hypothetical danger. But at the same time, we need to make sure people are taking reasonable steps to keep others safe.
That's the balance the courts are always trying to strike. And the Barmore case is a great example of that. The court was very clear that their decision was based on the specific facts of that case. If there had been any recent incidents, even something small, they likely would have ruled differently.
Any recent incidents? Okay, so that's a big deal. But what counts as a recent incident? A week? A month? A year? How do courts decide where to draw that line?
That's a really nuanced question. And to get a better grasp on it, we need to look at some other cases, cases where courts have dealt with similar issues. So in our next segment, we'll explore some contrasting cases that'll really help us understand the complexity of foreseeability and the factors that courts consider when determining whether a homeowner has breached their duty of care.
Okay, so let's talk about those contrasting cases. You mentioned earlier, we spent a lot of time on Barmore, and I think I'm starting to get the logic behind it, but some real-world examples would really help drive it home, you know?
Absolutely. So let's switch gears a little bit and look at a case that often gets compared to Barmore, Simpson v. Tiffin. This one involves a fraternity party where a guest got injured in a fight that was started by another guest who was, let's just say, very intoxicated.
Oh, okay. So a little different setting this time, but still a social gathering. Someone gets hurt. How does the fact that it's a frat house and not a private residence change things legally?
Well, the big difference here is timing. In Barmore, the son's violent history was a decade in the past, but in Simpson, the fraternity knew this guy was drunk and acting aggressively right before the fight even started.
Got it. So it's not just about knowing someone has a history of causing problems. It's about whether those problems seem likely to happen right now, in that moment.
Exactly. And the court in Simpson found that the fraternity should have intervened. They had a duty to step in and prevent the fight, especially since they were the ones hosting the party.
So if you're throwing a party and someone's about to clock another guest, you can't just sit back and watch.
Right. you have a responsibility to try to de-escalate the situation or kick the troublemaker out. The Simpson case really highlights that foreseeability isn't about predicting the exact future. It's about recognizing and responding to clear signs of danger in the present.
It's about connecting the dots, right? In Barmore, those dots were too far apart 10 years. But in Simpson, the fraternity had all the dots right there in front of them, blinking red.
Perfect analogy. Okay, so now let's jump to a totally different setting. Daly v. Denny's. In this case, a customer got injured during a robbery at Denny's, a Denny's restaurant.
Hold on, a robbery at Denny's? I'm trying to picture how a pancake house ends up in a premises liability lawsuit. It's not exactly a high-risk environment, is it?
Well, the customer who got injured sued Denny's, claiming that they should have done more to protect their customers from crime, especially since that specific Denny's had been robbed before.
Oh, I see. So the argument is that if a place has a history of crime, they need to beef up their security to protect their customers. Which kind of makes sense. Isn't that part of their duty of care?
It's a valid argument, for sure, and that's exactly what the customer's lawyers claimed. But here's the twist. The court actually sided with Denny's.
Really? What? If they knew they were in a high-crime area, and they had been robbed before, what more did they need?
Well, the court basically said that businesses do have a responsibility to protect their customers, but they're not expected to be fortresses. They can't prevent every single crime.
So even if a place has a history of incidents, they're not automatically responsible for every future incident.
That's right. In Daly, the court found that Denny's had taken some basic security measures. They had decent lighting working security cameras, and there wasn't anything to suggest that they could have specifically prevented that robbery.
It sounds like courts are always looking for that balance, right? Weighing the likelihood of a crime against the security measures a business has in place.
Absolutely. And these different cases show how complex that balancing act can be. It's not a simple formula. Courts have to consider so many factors. The type of property, the relationship between the parties, the history of past incidents, and the specific details of the event itself.
This stuff is complicated. No wonder lawyers have to go to school for so long. It's not just about knowing the laws. It's about understanding how to apply them to all these messy real-life situations.
Couldn't have said it better myself. And that's why cases like Barmore, Simpson, and Daly are so important. They force us to really think about these difficult questions, safety responsibility, and what we can realistically expect from others, whether it's our friends, the businesses we support, or even society as a whole.
You know, going through all these cases has really made me think about my own role in all of this. I'm not just a homeowner, right? I'm also a guest at other people's houses, a customer in stores and restaurants, a member of my community. We're all connected in this web of responsibility, and we all have a part to play in making the world a little bit safer.
That's a great point. It's not just about pointing fingers and suing people when things go wrong. It's about understanding these situations and working together to find solutions.
Couldn't agree more. Well, I think we've covered a lot of ground today, and I've definitely learned a ton, not just about the law, but about the human side of all of this. But before we wrap up, I want to leave our listeners with one final thought. We've been talking about foreseeability from a legal standpoint, but what about from a personal one? Imagine you're Leon Barmore, the guest who got attacked in the Elmore case. How would that experience change you? How would it affect how you view social gatherings or trust or even the idea of safety in someone else's home? It's a question worth thinking about and one that might stay with you long after this deep dive is over.